Hey, welcome, folks. This is Paul Nage with Touchstones, and you're here for another edition of Touchstones, where we explore religious experience as reflected in the members of a community of Carrboro and Chapel Hill and environs around the Triangle and Triad area. Today we have a special guest. Make this show legitimate. We actually got a bona fide reverend on the show today, not one of these bogus reverends that we occasionally have, such as myself. Today we have Dick Weston Jones, who not only himself has been a minister for many years, but was raised in a family where his father was a minister. And I don't know if it goes back any more generations than that, but he's shaking his head no here.
93 years between the two of us, though.
93 years of professional ministry, folks, as reflected in this experience. And I would actually like to share... Weston Jones is the minister of the UCH, which is also known as the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Hillsboro, a very nice little church out in Hillsboro. And if you are someone who doesn't like churches, then you would like the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Hillsboro, because it is a Unitarian Universalist church, which is very different than most churches, in that it has a long tradition of open and free conscience, where the attempt to find religion is left to the freedom of the individual living in community and attempting to find what is best for them in their own way. So it's one of the great free thought church movements in our society, which developed in counterpose to the Reformation. But that's another story, folks. So today, Dick, I want you to say a few words, and I'll see if you're actually broadcasting.
Okay, this is Dick Weston Jones, and speaking, and it's a pleasure to be here with Paul and speaking with all of you this morning.
Yeah, we may give you the phone number later to call in, folks, if you want. But right now, I want Dick to reflect a little bit on what, when you were a kid, you know, sort of those iconic moments when you were growing up, you know, those moments in which, you know, what was your experience of being, of growing up in the church with your father being the minister? That must have been a rough thing to carry around.
Well, I was the standard PK preacher's kid. The little old ladies loved to come up and kiss me and pat me on the head, which I disliked enormously, and as a result of that, I grew up determined that whatever I was going to do, I knew I wasn't going to go in the ministry.
Uh-huh.
And I promised my wife that, and it was only some years later, when I discovered that it was questionable as to whether I was really fit for anything else, that I made the decision to go to theological school and enter Unitarian Universalist ministry.
So you were probably then in your late 20s, early 30s?
I was in my mid-20s, early mid-20s. I guess I was probably, I haven't thought about that, but I was probably 23 when I decided, or something like that, when I decided to go on to theological school.
Right, so you'd been through college then, and
yeah.
Had
actually, I hadn't been all the way through college. I got all within 3 credit units of having a college degree, and I got so angry at the university I was going to, University of Louisville, because they said that they would not invite Arthur Miller to speak when we did one of his plays. I was in theater at the time. Because he was a communist, and I said, I don't want a degree from any school that makes that kind of a decision. So I walked out, which was not one of the brighter things that I have done, and I had to walk back in later and finish that that one course that I was lacking in order to be able to go on to graduate school.
Mm-hmm. I remember doing a similar, having a similar fits of pique, though I didn't necessarily ever repair any of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the you went on to theo, but so what was reminisce a bit on what your father was like and what the nature of Unitarianism at that time was. And it was Unitarianism at that time rather than Unitarian Universalism.
Well, my father actually was both a Universalist and a Unitarian, and that goes back to the genesis of our movement.
Right.
Back in the 18th century, a man named Ballou was the great leader of the beginning of Universalism, and Universalists tended to be in small towns or out in the countryside, and he said that we didn't need to believe alike in order to love alike, that he didn't believe in hell, or he did believe maybe there was hell, but it was only a temporary thing until the God that he could believe in would be taking everyone in, ultimately. So that was the Universalist position. It was universal salvation is where that idea came from. The Unitarians actually had a different stand. They were not believers in universal salvation necessarily, although they may well have been. But the Unitarians were a Christian movement, just as the Universalists were. But as Thomas Starr King, a great Unitarian minister of the 19th century, during the particularly known for what he did in the during the Civil War to help keep California on the side of the Union rather than going as a copperhead state. Thomas Starr King said the difference between the Unitarians and the Universalists is that the Universalists believe that God is too good to damn all people, and the Unitarians, said Thomas Starr King, believe they're too good to be damned. So that's the difference between the two movements. The Unitarians tended to be more more affluent. They were in cities or university communities, and we still tend to be in cities or university communities to this day.
It wasn't just about the time you went into seminary that the two movements officially merged. Wasn't that back in the
60s? 1961. The two movements merged, and my father, as I said, had been a Universalist minister in the small church on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. That's the one I grew up in, at least in the summers. But in the winters, or the rest of the year, he served Unitarian Church. And for a while, it was he was in Schenectady, New York, where I was born, and then he was in Lexington, Massachusetts, until he went into the Navy during the Second World War. And my mother and I were homeless during the Second World War.
Yeah,
because churches had parsonages for ministers, and if you didn't have a church as a minister, your family didn't have a parsonage.
Yeah,
so we wandered around, my mother and I, and we lived on the largesse of other Unitarian Universalists who took us in and took care of us.
What's amazing about the Unitarian Universalist movement, from my point of view, that I really like about it is, again, this thing that I'm alluded to earlier, which is the tradition of free thought. That among a number of churches, the Universalists wrangled with each other a great deal, and they thought, this is kind of, why are we fighting so much about universal salvation or about universal love? And the reason why is they were trying to doctrinally formulate it mm-hmm. in the way the old creeds were. This is minimally what they believed, and they discovered that this kind of formalization of belief led to divisions, led to schisms, led to rancor.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, is there's nothing new about rancor amongst theologians. They are probably the most, they have been historically known as the mm-hmm. most ill-designed debaters in the world,
mm-hmm.
and as far as that goes. But the they developed this view that in one's true conscience, which is a way that you make decisions within yourself, has to be left free. In other words, you have to have a free conscience, and you have to devote yourself to whatever you think your ultimate concern is, to borrow a phrase from Paul Tillich, or what your truth is. You have to find that for yourself in a way that works for you. Now, the other thing about Unitarian Universalism is that rather than being purely individualistic, we don't need a church if we're all going to be free individuals finding the divine on our own terms. But what you can do is you can recognize this general freedom that people have, and still know and understand that we need to live in community with each other with open conscience. That knowing the truth also or seeking the truth means that one has to learn to live truthfully with one another. You know, and this communal bond issue.
Yeah, people sometimes ask how many Unitarian Universalists are there in the country. We're not a large movement. Never have been, and probably never will be. I would be really surprised if we became a large movement. There are only probably a couple of 100,000 adult Unitarian Universalists in the United States today. However, there are lots and lots of people on the fringes of our movement, people who have the same values and like to be with others. And sometimes many of them call themselves Unitarians. My own view on that is that to be a Unitarian, you got to be in a community. You have to be in a church because otherwise there's no particular reason. You're just using a belief as a statement of what we're about. And the Unitarians are more into process than they are into belief. We think each man and each woman has the right and responsibility to determine their own beliefs. And in doing that, each person may choose where they need to go. It doesn't mean you can believe anything you want to. There are a lot of things I would love to believe that I really can't believe.
Yeah, right. Like ice cream won't make
you fat.
That's
right. Yeah. That's right. But you can believe what you have to. Mm-hmm. And as a Unitarian Universalist, you are appreciated and expected to be able to hold that position and share it with others and know that you are received, you're accepted, that you are not looked down upon because you might be the only person with a belief like yours. I'm a religious naturalist, but in our churches we have people who would call themselves Christians. We have people who are atheists. We have people who are humanists. We have people who still celebrate their Jewish roots. We have Buddhists. We have lots of people we have pagans. We have lots of people who, in fact, don't even have any particular label that they put on themselves because they don't like the use of labels.
Well, you know, one of the things that I remember, and after remember, I was actually went through a Unitarian Universalist seminary, folks, so I've got a slightly insider view that I haven't been active as a Unitarian Universalist in decades. But the one of the things that I'm always curious about, and what your take would be, is how many active adult Unitarian Universalists are come-outers? In other words, they've come out of another tradition and ended up in going through their own transition, ended up in the Unitarian. What do you think that what that might be at this point?
Well, of course, it depends on what part of the country you speak about and what church in particular. But I would say that at least 85 to 90% of our members are people who grew up either in no church or religion or in one that was not Unitarian, Universalist.
That's a very big number, folks. But then, of course, here's a big question, though. Mm-hmm. What happened to all those kids that went to religious education Sunday school?
Well, we really believe it when we say you really have to decide for yourselves. We're not really interested in telling you that you have to believe for yourself just as long as you're Unitarian Universalist. We don't say that. We want to encourage our kids to develop their own spirituality as they find it meaningful for them. And often when they reach adulthood, we find that they either partner with someone who is not a Unitarian Universalist in perspective, but can go along with them, but isn't going to be part of a church. And the Unitarian part of that partnership winds up supporting the other and going with them, or else they don't go anywhere at all. We have lots and lots of backslid Unitarian Universalists who celebrate the great outdoors on Sunday mornings.
Yeah, or as I do, the great sleep-in.
That's right.
Yeah, the great American sleep-in on Sunday mornings, or a read-in when we're reading the New York Times or something. But the it's just a question because I do know, you know, 20 plus years ago, there was a definite movement to begin to develop an appreciation, beginning in religious education, for the aspects of the rituals that bind us together, you know, or maybe bind is too tight a word.
Well, the word religion, of course, comes from binding back. It's the religio, the original Latin term, and that's really all it means. It doesn't say what you're bound back to.
Right.
It says nothing about a content. It's simply a way that you tie everything together in your life.
Right.
And there are some of our churches which actually are very high churches. There's one in Boston that is called King's Chapel because it was, in fact, the highest Church of England in the United States back before the Revolutionary War. They still follow a very, very conservative high church form of worship.
And they're more Anglican than most Anglicans.
Absolutely. And about 20 years ago, when there was a movement going through American religion about degenderizing language and using only gender-free terms, the church there looked at the Book of Common Prayer, which they were still using for 200 years. They had been using this, and actually the only change they made in it originally was to decapitalize the Holy Spirit so that it was no longer a part of the Trinity. And when there wasn't a capitalized Holy Spirit in the Trinity, then it became Unitarian. Well, 20 years ago, they said, well, maybe we ought to look at whether we should use only degenderized language. And they studied it very carefully and wound up deciding, nope, they liked the traditional language, and they continue to have very, very liturgical church services. They're unusual for a Unitarian church. We have, in the church that I serve, we have hymns or songs, and we have readings, responsive readings, and I speak on a subject of some sort. We light a chalice at the beginning of the service because this has become a binding thing for us. We've learned that that this part of the ritual really is something that we recognize and enjoy, lighting the light of truth. But whatever that truth is depends upon all the different ideas that people take.
Yeah, in other words, so when these rituals are done, they're not done with a supernatural purport. They're done with a sense of community. They're done as an agreed upon symbol for the community or for whatever it is.
Well, that's true in the church I serve.
Right.
But there are Unitarian Universalist churches that are very God centered, mm-hmm. and they would understand it in a very different way from the way the people that I work with do. And the president of our Unitarian Universalist Association, who incidentally is the first African-American to lead a major American denomination that wasn't already primarily black. Mm-hmm. He is a clear theist and gives those of us who are not really theistic in our theology, he gives us fits every once in a while because he would kind of like us to go back and use more of the
good
traditional
old
language.
God-centered language.
Yeah, he likes the language, and he thinks we miss that too much. And I do use God language on occasion when it's appropriate, but I don't think there's anybody in my congregation who has any idea that I'm speaking about a God who is out there somewhere making decisions about and could, in fact, turn history around or do something.
Back in the 60s and 70s, folks, there was part of the Universalist movement originally, which I guess goes back even to the 50s with Kenneth Patton.
Yes.
And what they were what it was noted for was using a wonderful euphemisms that for might be divine but wasn't. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, Ken Patton was a poet of religion. He was one of our most prominent. He was also a curmudgeon. He was a very difficult human being.
Uh-huh.
I only got to spend a few days with him once and came on to that. He would have a very sharp tongue,
uh-huh.
but he had a brilliant way of speaking that could touch your heart and how you looked at things.
And for a while in Boston, they had a church which was a sort of a Universalist Church of the Arts, in which mm-hmm. the idea was to embrace the good in all the world's religions.
And they, it had symbols of all the religions, or all the major religions, on the walls. And they also had a great deal of religious art all around.
Yeah.
And that church is, I believe, no longer there. I'm not sure.
I don't believe it is either.
It was just a small church, and many of us who were in the ministry at that time enjoyed going to it on those occasions when we came to Boston, if we didn't go to the King's Chapel, because we enjoyed that too. They had a beautiful service. I didn't agree with their theology, the predominant theology, but it was a beautiful service, and I enjoyed that thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the wonderful things about the Unitarian Universalism is that it's always been experimental. Back in the, '60s, there was a fellowship movement that was very predominant that eventually changed. The fellowship movement was basically lay-led congregations, and eventually they decided that there was it was difficult just to have lay-led congregations, and they tried to adapt professional development of professional theological leadership.
Well, that was true, but only of the congregations that grew enough to actually have sufficient resources to hire a professional or to call a professional, a minister.
Right.
We still have a lot of fellowships in the United States, Unitarian Universalist congregations, that don't have ministers. I work with, or I've just stopped working with, five of them in Alaska. I've been going to Alaska for years, working with those in the summer on an eco-cultural program that I led. Mm-hmm. And those congregations still operate, all but one of them, without a minister. The one in Anchorage is now 200 members, and they can afford a minister.
Right.
The congregation I serve in Hillsboro only has 60 members. And it's a struggle for them to pick up all the resources, including my half-time position as minister.
Right.
So we have both kinds today, but any of our larger churches, all of our larger congregations, that is, congregations that are 150 or more, have found that it's very difficult to work with a larger group of people without some kind of professional leadership.
Yeah, because there's too much demanded, and people want consistency in the service, which you're not going to get if it's lay-led. It's going to vary a lot.
Well, it still varies a lot with us. In Hillsboro, I do half the services, and the other half, they usually bring in an outside speaker on some topic that they believe will be of interest to the congregation. We make the same demand, which is none, about the theological position that person has to take. So recently we had a Black Baptist preacher who was speaking out of a very deeply committed evangelical point of view. He couldn't have done it in most of the Baptist churches in this area because he happened to be gay. And the church I serve in, the Hillsboro congregation, is a welcoming congregation. We believe that people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, they should be treated on exactly the same basis as everyone else. And we have a very active program supporting and inviting GLBT folks to come to our services.
Right. And there's also been a long initiative for the Unitarian Universalists, which is like most Protestant things, was a still predominantly Caucasian white group, but there's been a lot of movement to be welcoming to African Americans, and also Hispanics. There's also been a movement for towards the Hispanic movement.
Yeah, but we haven't gotten very far on that. It's unfortunate. When I grew up, the church I grew up in was a white supremacist Unitarian church. That was in Louisville, Kentucky. My dad was the minister, and it was shocking to me years later to read in his autobiography that he considered it a white supremacist church, not simply one that was predominantly white. And he explained to me that what happened after he went there in 1946, and by the mid-50s there were African-Americans who would come in once in a while. And because he believed strongly in the inclusion of all people, he parked my mother by the front door of the church so that when an African-American visitor might come in, she would take the person by the arm and go with them to sit with them in the congregation and make sure that the elders of the church
didn't chase them out.
Yeah. And at one point when the elders, we didn't have formal elders, but these were the prestigious older members. At one point, two of those men came to see my dad, and they said, "Bob, this cannot keep going on. Something may happen someday. One of those people may actually join the church, and we want you to stop it." And my father said, "Well," he said, "if you take it to the congregation and get the congregation to vote that they do not want black people to be part of our church, then I will accept that. But unless you take it to the congregation, anyone in this church is welcome and always will be as long as I am the minister." And the two elders went away and never raised the issue again because they knew that the congregation, in fact, didn't agree with them, and that although it had been a white supremacist church initially, because there was no challenge to that, it had become an inclusive church over the 8 or 10 years that my father had been the minister.
That's a very interesting sideline as far as the history of Unitarian Universalism. Basically, most Unitarian Universalist churches are very diverse. They are congregationally governed.
But we still don't have enough, anywhere near the numbers of African Americans that we should have. When I served the Unitarian Church, First Unitarian Church of Lynchburg, Virginia, I went there because I knew that Jerry Falwell needed some help in ministering to the community.
And, sounds like a good idea.
And yeah. So I went to be the minister of that congregation. My church there had about, on any given Sunday morning, 8 to 10% of the people in attendance were African Americans. But
that would be wonderful if that were true here. That would be wonderful inclusiveness.
Right.
Beginning at least.
There's a little Unitarian church in Durham called the Church of All Souls, which was organized, 10 years ago or thereabouts,
right,
intentionally to be a multiracial, multiethnic congregation. And they are still a very small congregation without a building of their own. I think the predominant reason behind this has more to do with demographics. Unfortunately, from my point of view, African Americans who are well educated and sophisticated tend to stay in their own community with the people that they have known, and that's really important for them and for their church communities. And so not many of them come to the Unitarian Universalist congregations, and we do tend to draw from a very highly educated, sophisticated, privileged group of people. And it doesn't matter what color you are, but the education tends to be a sign as to whether people are going to be more or less comfortable in our congregations. I wish it weren't, but it is.
I also want to say that locally in the Chapel Hill, Durham area, the Unitarian Universalist churches are numerous. There's a very big one. It's called ERUF, which is the Unitarian Universalist.
Eno River Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Although it has 500 members, it's still a fellowship.
Yeah, it was started less than 20 years ago.
Yes.
And it grew tremendously. In fact, some of the people that started that church were the ones that that went and split off and began a decade later to which started the Unitarian Universalist Church in Hillsboro, which is will remain probably on the smaller side.
Right. Right.
So you have a lot of choices here.
Right.
There's also
Chapel Hill. There is the Community Church of Chapel Hill, which originally was Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. Charlie Jones was the minister of the largest Presbyterian church in Chapel Hill. This was back in the 40s or 50s.
In the 50s, actually, it was the segregation and the civil rights movement that defined a number of these churches here.
And Charlie wanted his church to be open and insisted on it. And as a result, there was a hearing of some sort, and they said, "You are free to do that. outside.
Somewhere.
Not here. And so Charlie did leave, and a large part of the congregation went with him and formed the Community Church of Chapel Hill, which after he had retired, then went through a struggle for a number of years trying to find a minister who could serve a church that was diverse and as challenging as they were, and at the same time support the heritage which they had been in. They ultimately decided to look for a Unitarian Universalist minister, and they called Charlie Cast, who has recently retired
from there, yeah.
And Charlie served them for, I think, a dozen years. And so they became a Unitarian Universalist congregation, but they had been in existence as an unaffiliated or disaffiliated, I don't know what the Presbyterians call it, but
right.
Presbyterian church for years earlier, a Christian church. Today, it's virtually the same as any Unitarian Universalist church, much more like them than it would be like any Presbyterian church.
One of the things that's true about the South, this is from somebody who's from San Francisco originally and used to the West, is if you're looking for liberal people, the one of the best ways is to find your fellowship in some self ordained communities. We have one other. It's not related to the Unitarian Universalism, but it is related to the idea of free thought, which is and we also had the current leader on our show a few weeks back, Randy Best, and that's the North Carolina Society for Ethical Culture.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, the ethical culture movement has been a kind of companion movement.
Yes, we're a companion. It's a bedfellows.
Yes, the Unitarian Universalists have trained all their leaders. They've gone to our theological schools, and they have almost always been Unitarian Universalist ministers before they became ethical culture leaders. But that was a predominantly Jewish movement.
Started in 1875.
A man named Adler, yes, who started that. And it still is strong in a few cities, but it's got a very small number of congregations.
That's true. It just so happens that this particular group's been going well over 20 years, more like 25 years now. And, and it was started actually by a former Methodist minister who basically was tired of the theological and felt that the ethical core was the importance. It's also a movement. It meets at the Arts Center and has been there for years on Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. And
some Sunday when I have a Sunday off, I'll run by and
check
see what
it
they're
out.
Doing.
Yes, yeah. I was active there for a number of years. The we've discussed church and churches in this area for the last 30 minutes or so, and I want to like to sort of shift focus now. I want to shift focus into what is religion. Now we've been talking about the free church, the church that is not bound by dogmas or by constraints on conscience that are pre-formulated by belief or by demand of believing in the supernatural. Now, you said maybe we could start by asking you to tell us what you understand by being a religious naturalist, which is what you said you were.
Yeah, for me, everything that happens is natural. I may not understand it. Others may not understand it. But because it happens, it is natural. And as a religious naturalist, I put together my world, that is the ones in my head, which is the only real world I have that I think about. It's all the images and the ideas that I formulate. I do that on a completely naturalistic basis. I don't believe that there is any power outside the world or inside the world, which is supernatural, that what is there is there. That's not saying there isn't a power greater than me or greater than the world. There's certainly something is there because there's a power that brought everything into existence. But whether it is an intentional power, whether it is anything at all similar to what religions have referred to as God is another question entirely. But there certainly is a power beyond us which has created what we live with. And I am in awe of it. And I am also, I have to admit that there are times when I find it terrifying because of the horrible storms that sometimes come upon us where we are vulnerable. And I find it engaging and wonderful and worthy of worship. That is, worship itself is an old English word which refers to paying attention to things of worth, holding those things in our attention so that we appreciate them and hold them up for ourselves.
Well, or maybe some of that goodness or worth will rub off on us too. You know,
sure.
We become what we value.
Now, as a religious naturalist, I can easily do a service, which I did a couple of Sundays before Christmas, which was titled Jesus, What an Exciting Man. Because I think Jesus was an exciting man. The kind of position he took in a very, very authoritarian, very male-dominated, adult-dominated, brusque and macho kind of culture. And he didn't take those positions. He was a very soft man in many ways. I worked with the Jesus Seminar a number of years ago with the founder of that. And
it was Robert Funk, folks.
Yes. Yeah. And I take much the same position in looking at Jesus as they do, in which they said the Bible is the New Testament, the parts of the New Testament which relate to Jesus, which is only really in the received Bible, four books,
right.
Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And they say that most of the words in there really didn't come from him at all. They were put in his mouth by members of churches
the
writers
factions.
Later.
Yeah,
had nothing to do with it. But he may have said some of those, but they said only about 20% of the words attributed to him were probably original. But those 20% portray a very unusual man who stood up against much of the hatred and hostility in his culture. There's also hatred in some of his words. But those are words that the Jesus Seminar says he never said those words. It doesn't make sense.
So he wasn't into burning fig trees that
I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. But I can, as a religious naturalist, appreciate him, because he was, I am convinced, a human being who was so unusual in his time that he had a profound effect upon a lot of other people. And we are still celebrating and unfortunately killing people for today, doing all kinds of terrible things for, but some good things also. Religion has both sides.
And, you know, just to say that, you know, the normative Christian view of Jesus is that he was fully a human being and fully divine, which is a mystery and not necessarily to be understood.
Well, I don't have any problem with that as long as everybody in the world has the same makeup. But I don't know what it means to be fully divine, unless you are saying that that's what a naturalistic kind of way of being human is.
Well, that's the secret in one way, the secret of being fully divine. And you could say then that Jesus as the the exemplar, or Jesus as the as the shift in the epochs of the ages of what it is to be a human being, that by being fully human, we embrace being fully divine.
However, the irony of this is that he had no intentions of being the model.
Fully divine,
he may have accepted that part of it for himself, but he had no intentions of starting a movement. That was Paul's idea. Paul, who never saw him, but it wasn't Jesus's idea. Yes. He had no interest in starting any movement of any kind. He was working with people and the people he loved and people who frightened him and people he didn't really like. He was with them all the way.
There's also a good evidence. Eisenman, who's spent his life devoted to understanding James, who is the brother of Jesus, and whose book, James in the New Testament, is, in some ways, a very traditional Jewish work of good works and following the laws of the community, following the norms of the community. That's what he basically admonished to do. In fact, Luther thought that was a book that should not have been included in the New Testament. But that's another another story. The back to this religious naturalism. For instance, if you had an experience or had experiences of what might be some people might call telepathy, because these are the arguments that I get from people who come here who, you know, believe in a supernaturalist version of the world or something like that. You know, they say, well, you know, I know how to read thoughts and I can, you know, do this and, you know, I can divine tarot cards and, you know, and see into things like that. And, so to the degree that you might have an experience of telepathy, that would be you would still understand that in a natural thing, that it represents some qualities of the minds that we may not fully understand
yet. I had an example of this happen to me just yesterday. My wife and I were taking a walk in the neighborhood, and I had some ideas about suddenly why I had them, I don't know. But I was thrust back to when I retired the first time, which was in the year 2000. And someone had asked me what I was going to do with myself when I grew up. And I said, I thought I might do sculpture. I thought I've always loved sculpture. I have a lot of art in my home and thought that was what I would want to do. Well, I had not talked with her about this, hadn't really thought about it myself. I'd been too busy with the other things I'd been doing. But as I was walking down the street, the idea just came into my head, as ideas do with us. Did I want to think more about, was this really a time that I'd want to do something about that? Didn't say a word. And about 20 minutes later, after we had turned around and walked back toward the house, my wife said to me, you know, I really think you ought to think about going on. I just got a copy of the adult education guide for the Chapel Hill schools or school district or something, and they have a sculpture class that would be really maybe something you'd like to do. You once said you wanted to do that. Well, I haven't seen that publication, and I hadn't said anything to her about this, and she hadn't said anything to me. It was really remarkable that this idea came up in both of our heads.
Right.
I don't have any idea why. I am convinced that there are in the many different kinds of waves that I don't understand. I'm not a scientist, but there are ways of communicating beyond our ordinary ways that we all accept, and I accept that. I don't understand it. It's not supernatural. I think it's purely natural, and for me, I am very tuned into her, and she's very tuned into me, and it's not we have those kinds of experiences fairly often, but I don't have those experiences with other people. When I would take a walk with them, I don't have an idea pop into my head that's in their head, and I seriously doubt that happens with many people. There may be some people who are more tuned into their own listening and kind of catch ideas and looks on people's faces and kind of reflect that back, and it stimulates some ideas in common, but I don't think that most of us would have, in fact, any of us would have really that ability to call that up on demand.
Yeah, well, you know, you've been around long enough to where you remember when Sigmund Freud was revolutionary,
mm-hmm.
and what's kind of interesting in the last 20 or 30 years is that he discovered the significance of the unconscious, and specifically in understanding how we are human beings put ourselves together or are put together. And what's happened in the last 20 or 30 years, particularly with the rise of cognitive psychology, is we have, which is ironic in its own way, we are forgetting the unconscious again, is that there is this unconscious that is part of our consciousness, is part of who we are and how we're put together. You know, there's that subliminal communications that we don't pay attention to that could seem like telepathy.
All of us who are healthy tap into it with frequency at night with the dream
with
world
our dreams
that we get into. And it's certainly those ideas are coming from somewhere. And unfortunately, they often fade away in the morning. Many of us cannot remember what those wonderful dreams were. But there's something going on in there that we are not directing in our conscious lives.
Yeah, and there's actually the last show that I just had the last week was on dream interpretation, which it was a better than average show, as is this one. And the Thank you, Dick, for being a guest here. By the way, you are listening to WCOM in Chapel Hill and Carrboro at a 103.5 FM dial. And we're really happy that you've tuned in today. And this is Touchstones, and we've still got a few more minutes to continue our conversation. We're directing you now to specifically what religion might be and some of the issues that are coming up. One of the things that's really important, and I'm basically a religious atheist. You know, I've actually studied religions endlessly over my years, and I'm comfortable with theistic language. But my real, you know, if you strip me down in terms of what, you know, what stays with me most in terms of my practice, in terms of the kind of meditation I've done over the years or whatever it is, you know, I'm basically a Buddhist, right? Which is non-theistic, you know, doesn't make any serious metaphysical claims about anything, but also, believes in a certain way that there's a, you know, a sort of underlying necessary choice to, you know, choose the good, you know, that choose the compassionate, you know, in a way, you know, which is a demand. It's an ethical thing. You know, if you're going to choose something, choose what's good, choose what's life affirming, choose what, you know, what doesn't hurt, be assertively harmless, you know, which is, and I've stayed with that. I've allowed that to challenge me over the years, and whether there's ultimately a God or not, I know that at some deep level, there's something inside all of us that is good and that needs to be affirmed. In fact, that's what
I would say. It's inside most of us. I find it very hard to acknowledge that it is universal. I would love to acknowledge that it's universal, but I've had too much of my own life up against and working with some people
affirm it.
I spent a year as a student chaplain at San Quentin Prison, for example, and most of the residents there, who are otherwise sometimes called inmates, the residents were ordinary human beings, except very failed human beings. They had enormous difficulty putting their lives together in a positive and constructive fashion. They were rather sad people. There were not very many that I met there, but there were some who were admirable human beings. But I'd have to say that the admirable can be squashed in human life, and people can have it driven out, I think, utterly. And I think sociopaths are a good example of that. The people who have apparently no consciousness of anything that would be right or wrong, or a conscience, or any reason to feel any remorse for something that they would do that would be destructive, and simply go with wherever their demand inside takes them. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there is a devil or anything of that sort driving this. I just think that I doubt if there is a real form of good that is resident in all of us. Most of us have been carefully nurtured as babies and young children, and we've learned what we had to learn that was most important by the time we were a year and a half or 2 years old, and we can't get rid of that. It forces us to live the ways we live.
Yeah, I actually have known some people who didn't get that, you know, first year or so evidence, and who were
watch out.
this is true, and I mean, and the people I'm thinking of have, you know, had difficult lives and somewhat short and hard lives, but I remember, you know, they were attracted to the spiritual thing. They were attracted to trying to realize this goodness, and yet it was sort of like that Teflon that just wouldn't stick to them. Mm-hmm. They couldn't stick with it, and you know, and I realized this is, you know, it was a profound, whatever it is, that it was just really hard to do. Now, you know, what we have is, in some ways, we have a society that has optimized creating subhuman humans by, you know, not openly acknowledging the necessity for the family and the social supports that we all need as human beings, you know, prime basic supports. You know, the issue that we marginalize education, that we marginalize welfare. We blame people for being on welfare. You know, all of the things we do for a social net, we do in this society sort of curmudgeonly. And what this has done is it does create the conditions so that we may have more and more people who can't, for very profound developmental reasons, you know, click into some sense of goodness in themselves.
Well, I think it's actually a very small number. I really believe they're out there. I don't know what. I don't know of any studies that have said
the percentage is about 1-2%.
Yeah, so that they're out there, but they aren't very significant numbers. And I think most of the people who are most of the trouble in our society, the ones that we blame for it, I'm not talking about the ones who are really causing the trouble for our society, who are the people of power who set up situations that put other human beings in excruciating environments, but
yeah, as they say, let's not beat around the bush. Yeah. But that's
I would say that the president of our country has managed to screw things up spectacularly for a lot of people, and the end result of that he's not the only one, certainly, but you can see it in the death count, in the bodies, in the wars that we have going on now. And but at the same time, we recognize that in the inner city of America, we have in lower income areas predominantly, we have a very large number of young black men whose lives get them into terrible trouble, who cause terrible trouble for others. And something close to 30% of those young men, more than that actually, I think, have wound up either in prison or on probation by the time they are 30 years old, a very large subgroup.
Oh, yeah, it's actually my first show that we had that inaugurated this was we dealt specifically with prison ministries, and specifically that the issue is that we have more people in prison than any other society.
Now, it has nothing to do with their being black. Has nothing to do with their being in the inner city. It has to do with the conditions which lead, I think, to hopelessness and affirmation in destructive ways. They reinforce each other and certainly not just the blacks, because there are whites. And in the community where I lived for many years in California, Ventura, California, we had some affluent white gangs that were very proud of their behaviors that tended to be manifested in skinhead action. Yeah. But these were very, very privileged young people. But we do see an abnormal number of them in parts of our society that are most lacking in the resources. And you can predict it. It's when jobs are scarce, when income is hard to get, it goes up. And when jobs become more common and easier for people to get up, that behavior tends to go down, because I think most people would rather find a way, when they can, of affirming themselves in a productive fashion.
Yeah, well, and also in a way that has some regularity to it that allows things to go on. I noticed that you did bring in a couple of books that were related to some of the ideas of God. Is there anything you wanted to mention about them?
Sure. There's the one that's getting a lot of attention right now is The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. The advertisements on this, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for over 6 months. And I see now it's being advertised very heavily on television, which is amazing, because as a book about atheism by the world's most famous atheist, Richard Dawkins, it's running contrary to what is acceptable in our society. I mean, if you think...
People who read books are probably people who might question the idea if God is all that certain.
If people object to a Mormon being elected, I can promise you, atheists, openly avowed atheists, cannot get elected almost anywhere to any position in the United States. It's one of the things that the United States is really opposed to. This book is a marvelous book that deals with the God delusion.
Some of the lies or the implicit lies that go with the idea of atheism is that atheists are, because they don't believe in God, they have no reason to be moral, is one of the lies that comes up there. Because only people who believe in God or realize that they are going to be judged, you know, and that if I do something bad, this is the lie, folks. Yeah. This ain't the truth. Actually, you'll find that atheists will tend to usually have a pretty pretty clear inner moral standard in terms
actually,
of behavior
and stuff.
Actually,
I think probably if you take them across the board, you'd find probably that atheists have very high ethical standards, which they hold themselves to because there's no one else that they can consider themselves being held to. And they also tend to be very thoughtful people who have rejected the predominant ideas around them. And being thoughtful, they have made decisions about how they want to live and what a life worthwhile is. And so they are very ethical people. They're often much more ethical. And in fact, I met very few atheists when I was active in prison work. Very, very few of them. Lots and lots of fervent believers who kept getting into some trouble. A couple of the other books I wanted to mention, since this one is dealing with no God, is books by a man named Andrew Newberg, who is a precursor of a new move in theology called neurotheology. And neurotheology is that part of brain science which believes that what we believe is determined to an extent, heavily determined, by the makeup of the brain and what signals one part of our brain sends to another part of the brain and how they all come together to make our ideas and beliefs possible. It's very interesting. There's a book titled Why We Believe What We Believe. It's by Andrew Newberg. And I would recommend it very highly, no matter what your position is, whether you're a theist or an atheist or you're a pagan or a religious naturalist like me. It has a lot in it which will help you understand how your brain has made it possible for you to come down where you're coming down. Then he has another book called Why God Won't Go Away, and indeed he's saying God, the idea of God is hardwired into our brains, most of us.
Yeah, and I can understand the hard wiring of God into our brain. Not so much that there is a God in some supernatural sense, but that there is something. We have a sense of something that is profound in that way that moves us. I haven't come across Newberg. I did come across one study by a guy named Stan Gooch, and it's a great name there, in which again, going with this neurological thing, was trying to show how there was a lot of people. You know about hemisphericity. It's been around for a long time. This is the right brain, left brain divide. But we also have an interesting. We also have a sort of inner brain and outer brain thing that goes on, which is sort of like we have. Don't remember exactly. We have a cerebrum and a cerebellum. Mm-hmm. And what he was saying is that a lot of the channeled things was the cerebrum and the cerebellum having a conversation with one another. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. This gave, and a lot of the experiences that people have dissociatively of having channeled is that they actually have neurologically, they develop channels to which they have, as it were, like an alternate personality within themselves, which is this inner brain, and it can communicate in a variety of ways. It can communicate the still small voice, and he goes on, and so he actually tries to relate this to a variety of what are known as paranormal occurrences, and also the different types of experiences of channels channels, not only hear auditorially, but sometimes they'll pick up smells. Others will see colors or auras, and all of which are, you know, neurological phenomena and can be traced and understood to some degree. And people who practice meditation will often find that they will experience different senses of different locations, which is in some ways us exercising our brains in ways that our society doesn't demand of us.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we have, as it were, capacities, personal human capacities, which, you know, our society doesn't necessarily call on us to use. You know, they can be creative, or they can be entertaining in a certain ways. So we probably have more natural capacities to be high or ecstatic in ways that are well beyond anything that we could normally find in the uses of drugs or alcohol.
Now, whether the idea of God is one which is put into us by some power beyond us, and therefore that power designed the brain in order to be a receptor of what God wanted to be received, or whether it is an idea that is created ex nihilo by the brain out of its own capacity to do those things, is a question that remains open. And nobody in neuroscience really has the answer to that one.
And on that note, folks, we're going to conclude our show for today. This has been Touchstones. I am your host, Paul Nagy. We've been talking to help me.
Reverend Dick Weston Jones.
Dick, yes, he knows it better than I do, and I'm really happy that he's been here. It's been a wonderful opportunity. I hope that some of you take the invitation to explore or find out about Unitarian Universalism if you are so inclined to that style of religion, as was described eloquently by our guest today. So on that note, until next week, so long.